of oil as we understand it or don't understand it. But after reading the book, you'll have a much better handle on it.
The Jeff Rentz program continues.
Richard Heinberg is here, and his book, The Party's Over, the subject of this first portion of the program tonight, Top Oil Exporting Countries as of May 1 year ago. Saudi Arabia, 6.6 million barrels per day. Russia, 4.8 million barrels a day. Norway, 3.1 million barrels per day. Iran, 2.4 million barrels per day. Venezuela, 2.3 million barrels per day. Remember, Iran is an oil exporter. We don't usually think of them as such. Estimated dates of production peak for these countries. Saudi Arabia is expected to peak in 2017. Russia in 1987. They're definitely on the downside. Norway, 2004. Iran, 1976. They're on the downside. Venezuela, 1970. They're definitely way past peak. So interesting things. Now, years ago, I was told, and it's probably close to 20 years ago, I was in college, that we have in the contiguous 48 states, about a 500-year supply of oil at the current level of energy consumption back then in coal, oil, shale. Now, it's certainly harder to get the oil out, but there's that much energy and oil sitting around in the ground here. Have you come across that statistic or anything close to it?
Right. That's true in principle. The problem is that resource, shale oil or oil shale, is an entirely different beast from conventional oil that exists in pools in the ground that you pump out. Shale oil, it's actually technically known as organic marlstone, has to be mined and processed, and the amount of energy required to do that mm-hmm. ends up being almost as much as the energy that the oil that you make out of it has
almost
when
one
you
for one,
the
huh?
process. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's extremely expensive in dollar terms and also in energy terms. Canada has a huge resource also in terms of the tar sands in Alberta.
That's right.
It's a somewhat similar situation. Actually, the tar sands are easier to produce than the shale oil. And Canada's been able to ramp up production to over 200,000 barrels a day with the oil sand or with the tar sands or oil sands. But the rosy predictions that say that Canada can be the next Saudi Arabia are almost certainly not likely to be fulfilled because of the immense cost of producing this stuff.
The amount of gasoline or diesel fuel used to produce one bushel of corn in Iowa, 2.5 gallons.
Right. We're eating oil right now, effectively. I mean, the amount of oil energy in each calorie of food far exceeds the food value.
Wow.
The typical food item travels 1,300 miles from farm to plate now, and those are, of course, fossil fuel miles. Plus, there's fossil fuels in the fertilizers, the nitrogen fertilizers that are made from natural gas, and then the pesticides and herbicides, and then the farm machinery, tractors and combines and so on. So when you add all of that together, modern industrial agriculture is probably the most energy inefficient form of agriculture ever practiced by human beings.
Fortunately, there is a small but growing movement of people with their diesel engines using biodiesel. They're making their own.
That's right. I actually run my car on biodiesel.
Do you?
I don't make my own just because I, quite frankly, I don't have the time to mess with it, but I have a number of students at New College who make their own biodiesel.
Yeah, right. It's kind of a thing. What kind of an automobile do you drive? What
I drive an old 1980 Mercedes 300D.
Mm-hmm. There you go. There you go. That's the way to go.
It's a cheap and efficient form of travel.
They'll last forever, those engines.
That's right. Yeah, they'll go 500,000 miles.
Okay, biodiesel is something that a lot of people can relate to, and as you just heard Richard say, a lot of his students at New College are actually making their own. It's simple to do. On the internet are a number of sites that talk about biodiesel. That's an easy one. All right, what about we've got oil shale, we've got tar sands. What about cracking coal down and deriving some kind of oil substitute from that?
Well, it can be done, but again, it's going to be very expensive because coal is much less energy dense than oil. In other words, pound for pound, oil has a lot more energy in it. So therefore, if you're going to make gasoline from coal, it's bound to be more expensive just on that basis alone. Then with coal, we run into the problem of energy profit ratio. You know, it takes energy to get energy, as we've been saying. And with coal, the energy profit ratio has been declining remarkably year after year. That's because even though theoretically there's, you know, a 300-year supply in the ground, mm-hmm. a lot of that is not very easily accessible, and it takes a lot of energy and monetary investment to get at it. The cheap, easy stuff, the stuff you can mine right off the surface of the ground, is going rapidly. And the stuff that's left is buried deeper, and it's of lower quality. So we're not going to see that 300 years of coal at current usage rates. We'll be lucky to maintain current usage rates for probably 25 to 30 years.
But most people, I think, are coming to the point where they realize that if they ought to drive less to compensate for that. If they could just cut their trips down and combine trips, they can actually reduce their driving 10-15%. Without much trouble, and start to make up that deficit a little bit and do their part. Because I do understand and empathize with the safety aspect of it. We kill 40,000, 45,000 people a year on these highways, and we injure 2 or 3 million a year. And if somebody wants to be safer in a bigger car, to me that's an okay argument. But I think they've got to think about the long term and what they're doing to the planet by cutting their trips down. That's how I approach it.
Right. Yeah, we're also killing a million wild animals a day on roads in this country.
Well, we're eating 11 billion of them a year, killing them. Billion. 10 to 11 billion animals, from fish to cattle, are killed and eaten in this country every year.
Right.
Billion.
But,
10 billion. That's ridiculous. No, it's a good point.
Yeah. Sooner or later, though, we won't even have that kind of choice in front of us, because as the cheap fuels begin to run out, it won't be sort of an ethical or a moral issue. It'll be purely an economic issue as to whether we can drive.
Well, that day won't come too soon for a lot of people. Now, you're an environmentalist. We talk about the number of gallons of gasoline or diesel to produce a bushel of corn, which is 2.5. How much water does it take to produce a pound of beef? How much grain does it take to? I think it's 75 or 80% of the grain raised in America goes to feed livestock. I forget how many hundreds of gallons of water, maybe thousands of gallons, for one cow to reach maturity and weight. And then, of course, that water is in many cases polluted with all sorts of hormones, additives, and chemicals. It is then put back into the ground and begins to foul streams, rivers, groundwater tables. It's an amazingly stupid system, the whole thing.
Right. Our whole industrial system has carried a huge price tag, actually, when we look at it, not only in terms of the environment, but also our peace of mind and the integrity of our communities. If you look at the history of the Industrial Revolution, everywhere that it's occurred, there's just been a huge cost involved. And so as the Industrial Revolution may be coming to a conclusion in the next few decades as a result of our running out of the basic fuel that has kept the Industrial Revolution going since the beginning, there may be some upsides to it. And I think it probably would be a good idea for us to pay attention to what some of those payoffs may be.
Mm-hmm. Certainly should. Nuclear energy, hasn't been a new nuclear plant, 103 reactors here in the States. Europe is, Germany is trying to go nuclear free and get rid of all of its nuclear power.
Correct, yeah.
Which I wholeheartedly salute. I think that's a true visionary process they're going through. I don't know what's going to happen here with more nuclear power plants or less, but how do you see it?
Well, I don't think nuclear is a good idea for a number of reasons.
It's a terrible idea for all reasons. Sorry. Not one single nuclear plant has ever turned a profit.
Right. I mean, the energy profit ratio from nuclear is extremely low once you factor in the plant construction, the mining and processing of uranium, and then the storing of the spent fuel and the decommissioning of the reactor at the end of its lifetime. It's an incredibly expensive form of energy production. And the mining of uranium has been devastating ecologically and cost untold human lives from miners and their families.
True.
So that would be a good industry just to, you know, sort of watch it go on its last legs and pass away from existence.
But, yeah, and then how many metric tons of liquid waste, which will stay deadly for hundreds of thousands of years, do we have to deal with, which is sitting in basically, if you will, swimming pools all over the country? And that's what they put them in, just a concrete hole in the ground.
Right.
That's unbelievable.
The nuclear industry, I think, is poised for a comeback. At least it's trying to make one. It's spending a lot right now on public relations. And it's trying to portray itself as a green industry.
I know.
Non-polluting.
I know. What a joke.
And I think it's going to be using hydrogen, actually, as a selling point.
Oh, they'll do all the marketing. Will be, of course, the best money can buy. They'll pitch it to the American public. Yeah, you bet.
They'll be telling us if we want to drive hydrogen cars in the future, then we have to have lots more electricity in order to be able to make that hydrogen.
Right.
And the only source that we can get all of that electricity from is more nuclear power plants.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I think it's important to examine this the hydrogen economy idea really closely. I'm sure hydrogen will be useful in a lot of niche applications as we sort of round the energy corner and make the transition. But unfortunately, I think the nuclear and coal industries are picking up on this. And when President, and I use the term guardedly, Bush, in his State of the Union address promised, I think it was $1.6 billion for research in hydrogen fuel cell cars. You look closely in the fine print, you see all of that money is going to nuclear and coal as sources for the hydrogen.
Politics is lies. It's what it is anymore.
Yeah.
Tell us more about the consequences, what this whole oil economy has done to our nation economically, physically, and all of that.
Well, the economy is dependent on energy, not just for the amount that we spend on energy resources, which is, after all, a relatively small part of the economy, maybe a few percentage points. But if you look at it more systematically, the whole economy is about energy because energy is the capacity to do work. So without energy, nothing happens. So
you're talking, of course, about consumer items, all manufactured with energy.
Right.
Food, all of it, fast food, all of it. You're right, the whole thing, energy-driven.
Right. I mean, people going to work, how do they get to work? Without energy, literally the entire economy would stop dead in its tracks. So as we round the energy curve, as fossil fuels peak in production and we have less net energy year after year to fuel industrial societies, that means we're likely to see a whole range of effects, economic effects, also effects in agriculture, food production, because so much of our food production is based now in fossil fuels. We're likely to see cost of food increase. We're already likely to see that as a result of a natural gas crisis that's coming just this summer. So the range of effects goes on and hits virtually every aspect of our lives.
Another natural gas crisis this summer?
Yeah, actually that would be good to talk about in a little bit more detail.
We will. We'll talk about wind power as well and some other things. This is really a neat book. It's a book whose time is certainly here. Richard Heinberg is my guest. That's H-E-I-N-B-E-R-G. The book, The Party's Over.
And now, the Jeff Rentz program continues.
Is my guest. We're talking about oil and energy. Very sensible stuff being discussed. It's all in his book, The Party's Over. Excellent title. All right, Richard, you wanted to pursue that one thread there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about natural gas a little bit more because we're leading up to a real crisis situation here over the next 6 to 18 months. Right now, natural gas in storage is at its lowest level in many years. And typical
Why?
Resource depletion. Typical new natural gas well in the U.S. is 60% depleted in the first year.
A U.S. Columbia policy, and to order the book, The Common Good.
We're getting 1 year?
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't deplete the way oil does. Oil is, you know, liquid and viscous, but natural gas can just be sucked right out of the well. We're getting 17 or 18% of our natural gas from Canada. I was just up in Vancouver yesterday, and the Canadians are starting to become nervous because their production is peaking there. It's starting to go downhill. And
they're exporting, though, too.
They're exporting 60% of what they produce to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Canada is kind of a cold, dark country, and if they have to, under the rules of NAFTA, they have to continue exporting 60% of what they produce to the U.S., even if they fall short of what they need for their own purposes, their own uses. So they're starting to become nervous about the situation. And we're looking at kind of a perfect storm situation developing over the summer because it's likely to be a warmer summer than usual, which means more air conditioner use, therefore more electricity demand. And we have a lot of new electrical power generators coming online that burn natural gas. Also, several nuclear power plants are going to be down for normal maintenance, which means less electricity coming from them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the summer is supposed to be the injection season for when we put more natural gas in storage for the winter months, which are the drawdown season when we use natural gas to heat our homes.
Got it.
So by the time we get to next winter, we won't have enough natural gas in storage probably to make it through next winter. That's why Dick Cheney is convening in June a natural gas summit. But there aren't any easy answers on the horizon. I'm sure he's going to say, well, we'll encourage production and so on. But, you know, production's already going flat out. The problem is the stuff just isn't there.
It takes a crisis, seemingly, to get this country, this Western world, to make positive, creative, and reasonable responses to situations which ought to be taken care of already. But we may be heading toward that situation, that very thing.
Right. We tend to follow the economists, you know, and the economists tell us that it's impossible to run out of any resource because if something starts to get scarce, the price goes up, and that encourages investment in alternatives. And in general, that's true with most things, but with energy resources, it's a little different because you can't replace your energy.
Call us toll-free, 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number for Visa or MasterCard orders is 1-800.
But you're overnight, and price signals don't give you any warning. The market doesn't tell you. The market only tells you if something's scarce right now. It doesn't tell you if it's going to be scarce 5 or 10 years from now. It doesn't give you that lead time that you need in order to rebuild your energy infrastructure. And we need literally decades to do that.
Huh, really good point. Okay, wind energy.
Right.
You see the big turbines occasionally, the big blades, those propellers on people's property. If you live in a windy area and you've got the money, is it to a point where it's cost-effective to go ahead and put in a bank of, 6 or 12 deep-cycle batteries, big batteries,
yeah,
and put up a propeller? A
Absolutely. Yeah, wind is probably the most cost-effective in terms of energy return on energy invested of any of the alternatives that are available, with the possible exception of micro-hydro. And if you don't have a stream running through your property, but you do have a good wind resource, then wind turbines are a very good way to go. And that's true not just on an individual basis, but also for communities and for whole regions. If the wind resource is there, in third.
444-1977. Or you can send in your check. Cassettes are $13 plus $1 for postage. Printed transcripts are $9. The address, AR PO Box 551, Boulder, Colorado 0306. Martin Folker recorded the program. AR's general manager is Joe Rich.